Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. The ongoing tale of Nippon Steel buying U.S. Steel may have taken a new turn. Japan is still upset at the tariff Trump imposed on them and argues that its tariff on U.S. rice imports is being misrepresented by Trump. The Chinese president is holding talks across Southeast Asia, including Vietnam, attempting to prevent U.S. bullying. Japanese officials held tariff negotiations with Washington. The auto tariffs are especially crippling to Japan and U.S. consumers. Ukraine and Russia continue to bomb each other's energy infrastructures. NHK Japan.
The drawn-out saga of Nippon Steel's buyout bid for U.S. Steel has taken another turn. Earlier this week, President Trump indicated he may be warming to the plan. Now he's pouring cold water on it again.
And we love Japan, but for a foreign country to buy that cherished U.S. Steel brand, that's hard for me to do.
Trump had previously said he opposes the buyout deal. But on Monday, he instructed a national security panel to take another look at the transaction. The directive gave people on the Japanese side reason to be upbeat. But any hope they may have felt is likely fading after Trump's latest remarks. The president claimed Nippon Steel has come back to the table as an investor. He said he feels better about that arrangement. Nippon Steel has made it clear it remains committed to acquiring the American firm.
It's a little hard to keep up. To remind people watching, the U.S. hit Japan with a 24% tariff this month before quickly dropping it to 10% as part of a 90-day pause to set up new trade deals. But that 24 number could still come back. How does Tokyo make sense out of it?
The government says it doesn't understand how the U.S. arrived at that figure. Prime Minister Ishiba has continued to point out that Japan has contributed a lot to the U.S. economy. Just this week, he told Trump by phone that Japan has been the largest investor in the U.S. 5 years in a row. Ishiba says Japan should not be treated the same as other countries. He says the government will continue to call for a review of the levies.
Washington is also criticizing Japan over its own tariffs. It claims Japan has a 700% tariff on rice. Tell us about the response to that.
Tokyo says the claim is illogical. While it's true there is a tariff, the U.S. is not portraying it accurately. Japan has a mandatory tariff-free import quota. The amount for the U.S. totals are almost 350,000 tons. That's almost half of the entire tariff-free import quota. Imports outside of this are subject to a levy of 341 yen per kilogram, about $2.30. So America's claim about the 700% tariff does not reflect reality. The big focus now is on a new trade deal with the U.S. Ishiba says the government will pursue a wide range of cooperation that will benefit both countries.
China is also making moves in the face of U.S. tariffs. President Xi Jinping held talks with his Vietnamese counterpart Tô Lâm in an effort to shore up trading partners. Xi arrived in the Vietnamese capital Hanoi on Monday. Beijing appears set to counter Washington by pivoting to Southeast Asian nations. That includes building on already strong economic and trade ties with Vietnam. Xi met with Communist Party General Secretary Tao. Xi said both countries should jointly oppose unilateral bullying and maintain the stability of the global free trade system. The administration of U.S. President Trump has declared a 46% tariff on Vietnam. The measure has been put on hold, but there have already been significant shockwaves in the business sector. The two countries are in territorial disputes in the South China Sea, but in recent years they have been deepening economic ties, including trade and railway projects.
Japanese officials have held their first tariff negotiations with their U.S. counterparts. Economic Revitalization Minister Akazawa Ryosei said the talks were frank and constructive.
I relayed the message to President Trump that Prime Minister Ishiba would like to realize a comprehensive agreement between Japan and the U.S. as soon as possible to strengthen both economies. I strongly requested a review of the tariff policy.
One sector where Japan cannot afford concessions in tariff negotiations is automobiles. The Trump administration has imposed an extra tariff of 25%. One estimate says that could push down the combined operating profits of the six main Japanese automakers by more than $20 billion. Trump also plans more tariffs on auto parts. That would impact manufacturers in Japan and the United States.
If you don't have factories here, they're going to have to get going and build them because otherwise they have to pay tariffs. Very simple.
The additional 25% auto tariffs took effect 2 weeks ago. Some Japanese automakers are shifting production to the U.S. Nissan is reassessing a plan to reduce production in the U.S. and adjusting production of U.S.-bound models in Japan. Honda plans to transfer production of some models from Japan to the U.S. The extra tariffs will also affect companies in the U.S. This firm analyzes where car components come from. Tesla builds its mainstay model in the U.S., but this component is made in Mexico. Another comes from South Korea. Only 70% of the car's parts are sourced in the U.S. With models from other U.S. automakers, analysts found the proportion of U.S.-made parts is even lower at about 40%. With so many parts made outside the United States, the additional tariffs are sure to impact U.S. automakers. Research firm director Asada Hiroyuki does not think existing practices can be sustained.
They've been sourcing some parts overseas. This is what they build up, but it's all going to collapse.
Asada said, ultimately, the impact will also likely be felt by American consumers. Ukraine and Russia are accusing each other of violating a limited ceasefire brokered by Washington last month. Both say the other side has launched attacks on energy infrastructure, threatening to upend the deal. Kyiv's foreign ministry told reporters that Moscow has launched numerous attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure since the pause was supposed to have taken effect. The spokesperson says Ukraine wants a temporary ceasefire to be extended, but it's up to Russia to keep up its end of the deal. Moscow's defense ministry leveled similar allegations against Kyiv via social media. It claims Ukraine launched six attacks against Russian energy facilities, including some in the western region of Belgorod and Bryansk on Tuesday and Wednesday. It also claims such attacks are happening daily. Ukraine and Russia agreed to pause attacks on energy infrastructure following talks with U.S. negotiators in Saudi Arabia last month.
Those reports are from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, France 24. Three press reviews and a report. First, a press review on Hungary constitutionally banning LGBTQ gatherings. Press reviews on the UK Supreme Court ruling that only people biologically women are entitled to sex-based protections. Then a press review of a New York Times article about Netanyahu being held back from a plan to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. Finally, a report from a Paris demonstration by journalists protesting the 170 journalists killed by Israel in Gaza. France 24.
Emily's going to bring us more on the Hungary story as well, passing that legislation banning LGBTQ plus gatherings. So what about the Hungarian press? How are they covering it?
Yes, well, let's start with the Hungarian news site Telex. They have this story here, and they report that the Fidesz majority in the National Assembly approved the 15th Amendment of the Constitution by 140 votes to 21. The amendment says there are only two sexes and therefore denies gender identities. It says that the protection of children takes precedence over the right to demonstrate, effectively banning other pride marches, and it also limits the rights of dual nationals. Now, the other Hungarian news, Népszava, here headlined with comments from the Hungarian Helsinki Committee. The human rights organization said the amendment aims to sow fear and divide society in the country. It says the government is manipulating the constitution to achieve political objectives regardless of the harm it causes to its citizens. Now let's move to France, where the LGBTQ plus outlet Titu here has this headline: Hungary writes LGBT phobia into its constitution. It says the law is the backpedaling that populists worldwide have always dreamed of. It also calls it anti-trans legislation and an extension of Trumpism, which doesn't stop at European borders. Now, the New York Times calls it a continuation and an escalation of the culture wars. The article accuses Orbán of using the law to divert public attention away from economic problems and rising opposition in the run-up to next year's parliamentary elections.
Coming out of the UK, this is the story we covered yesterday morning. In the end, the Supreme Court did rule that the legal definition of a woman is based on biological sex. How have the papers been covering this, Emma?
Let's start with the right-wing tabloid, the Daily Mail, which is quite happy with the result. They call it a historic victory for women and common sense. Now, the Daily Telegraph headlines with "Trans women are not women." They also have this photo of two activists from the gender critical group For Women Scotland, clearly celebrating their win in front of the courts there. And this photo was used widely all over the press. The Independent takes a slightly different angle on their front page. They're looking at the consequences that the ruling might have for trans women, calling it a blow to their rights. It says that it could set a dangerous precedent that erases protections for trans people. On the Guardian's website, there's this explainer looking into the implications of the ruling. They explain here that it could mean that transgender women with a gender recognition certificate can still be excluded from single-sex spaces if it's considered to be proportionate. The policy areas affected include gender in sports and the armed services, hospitals and access to changing rooms and women-only spaces.
The New York Times has an article. It's discussing divisions in Donald Trump's administration.
Yes, the New York Times has this very interesting long read today. Trump waved off Israeli strike after divisions emerged in his administration. It reads, the article says that Israel had planned to strike and destroy Iranian nuclear sites as soon as next month. Initially planned as a commando operation, Israeli officials later proposed a bombing campaign, which would have lasted several weeks and needed US assistance. But the attacks were waved off by Donald Trump in favor of renegotiating with Tehran to limit its nuclear program. It says Trump made his decision after weeks of bitter internal debates. The article highlights the fault lines between historically aggressive US cabinet officials and other aides who were more skeptical that a military assault on Iran could destroy the country's nuclear facilities and avoid a much larger war.
solidarity for the journalists killed in Gaza since 2023. Here, demonstrators wearing fake flak jackets. You can see them behind me showing pictures of those journalists killed moments ago. They were lying on the ground. Again, of course, a symbolic action and moments. Some of the journalists here in the past were able to go into Gaza to report on various Israeli operations. They can no longer do so. The Israeli army preventing any journalists from going into the territory. France 24 had a handful of journalists who were able to go in, escorted by the Israeli army, taken to carefully selected locations for 20 minutes or so, and unable to talk to Palestinian civilians there. So clearly a situation of media blackout, impossible to report freely from inside Gaza on the war that's currently going on. There's recently been a report released by the Watson Institute for Public and International Affairs. It belongs to Brown University in the US, and it shows that when you take the number of journalists killed in the American Civil War, Yugoslavia, Vietnam, World War I and World War II, when you take all of those wars and the number of journalists killed put together, it doesn't amount to the number of journalists killed in Gaza since 2023. We're talking over 170 journalists killed.
Those press reviews and report were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, as well as most podcast sites. On to Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The European Union announced a 1.6 billion euro financial package for infrastructure to the Palestinian Authority. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The European Union has announced a 1.6 billion euro financial package for infrastructure in the Palestinian territories, including Gaza. Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Mohamed Mostafa traveled to Luxembourg for talks hosted by the EU's top diplomat, Kaya Kallas. The meeting was aimed at discussing solutions for Gaza, which the EU wants the Palestinian Authority to govern after the war. The funding to be paid to the authority over 3 years is conditional on EU demands for democratic reforms. Well, our correspondent Terry Schultz is following these developments. Welcome, Terry. So what does the EU want to see this money spent on?
This money, the 1.6 billion you mentioned over the next 3 years, will be split in 3 ways, Phil. About 600 million of it will go directly to the Palestinian Authority, what's recognized as the legitimate government of the Palestinian people, to support it and, key, to reform it. That's really important here. About another 600 million would go to what's being called recovery and resilience in the West Bank and Gaza, much of which, of course, is completely destroyed, and this would also cover some humanitarian aid. And then there's about another 400 million that would be available in loans from the European Investment Bank, and that would go to Palestinian Authority institutions to help build them back up. But we really have to emphasize, as you did before, that reforming the Palestinian Authority is key to this money going forward, to the relationship strengthening, because there have been allegations of corruption. And this is something that Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Mohamed Mostafa was very much made aware of today in his meetings with EU high officials here in Brussels. This was the first ever EU-Palestinian high-level dialogue, so there's a lot riding on it.
And so how will they make sure that none of these millions end up in Hamas coffers?
I think that's a very difficult guarantee to make, but certainly the calculation on both sides is that by strengthening the Palestinian Authority, which is recognized as the only legitimate government of the Palestinian people, you would show that this prime minister comes home with 1.5 billion euros over the next 3 years. You show that this is the partner that EU countries want to have. And in that way, certainly they're hoping that the Palestinian people turn away from Hamas, which is a recognized terrorist organization, which has brought so much destruction on them. That's certainly the way that both sides here want to move forward.
Stay with us, Terry. We're going to hear from the EU foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, who has been very critical of Israel's actions in the Palestinian territories. We'll hear from her and then come back to you.
Let me again express our solidarity with the Palestinian people at the appalling loss of life and destruction in Gaza. We condemn the total blockade of aid into Gaza, and Israel must fully reinstate humanitarian aid. In the West Bank, we are very concerned about the worsening situation. This includes the displacement of tens of thousands of people, as well as the restricted access to essential services such as healthcare and education.
So very direct criticism of Israel there from Kaya Kallas. Terry Schultz in Brussels. Is that criticism shared by all 27 EU governments?
Certainly it's shared by some of them. There are many, including Kaya Kallas herself, who have expressed that Israel's response has been disproportionate, that it has been too destructive on civilians in the Palestinian territories. But there are other countries who believe, of course, that Hamas is fully to blame. And Kaya Kallas herself talked about disagreements that happened at this meeting here today, where some countries want to put sanctions on extremist Israeli settlers for what they've done against Palestinian civilians, but she said they couldn't find unanimity on that. Meanwhile, Hamas is heavily sanctioned, Hamas individuals. So that remains a disagreement. Also, fewer than a dozen EU member countries have recognized Palestine as a state. But this is something, again, that may be changing. For example, French President Emmanuel Macron has come out and said that he expects France will recognize a Palestinian state at a big UN conference in New York in June. So this could be a turning point. But again, going back to what we spoke about at the beginning, this goes along with the Palestinian Authority showing that it can be a trusted partner and really regaining legitimacy, not just in the eyes of the Palestinian people, but also in its international partners around the world. But things could be changing for the better when it comes to governance of the Palestinian territories.
Okay, thanks for that, Terry. Terry Schultz in Brussels.
That report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. Deutsche Welle is also up at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like a listener in Trinidad, California, and subscribers in Willits and Cleveland did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show in the airwaves. Please join the fun. And if you're listening on a public radio station, they will soon have an even greater need for your support as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The opposition in Panama has called the influx of U.S. troops a camouflage invasion. U.S. human rights advocates have filed a lawsuit to halt a Trump executive order imposing sanctions on the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Panama's opposition have accused the United States of launching a camouflaged invasion of the country after U.S. President Donald Trump confirmed the deployment of U.S. soldiers days after the two countries signed a security pact. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has confirmed that details, including a memorandum of understanding, were reached between the U.S. government and the Panamanian authorities in efforts to, quote, secure the Panama Canal from Chinese influence. Hegseth said in a statement that the Panama Canal Authority would allow U.S. warships and auxiliary ships first and free passage through the canal that connects the Pacific Ocean with the Atlantic and is a chief conduit for global trade. The U.S. Defense Department head added that the U.S. troops would be deployed at three former military bases, Fort Sherman, Rodham Naval Base, and Howard Air Force Base, as part of a deal signed by Panama's Ministry of Public Security, raising concerns and anger in Panama. The last U.S. troops were pulled out from the country in 1999. In a video posted on social media, Ricardo Lombana, the leader of the opposition Another Way movement, called the memorandum of understanding reached between the United States and Panama an invasion without firing a shot. Earlier, President Trump confirmed that U.S. soldiers and military personnel will be deployed to Panama as part of the deal, telling reporters, "We've moved a lot of troops to Panama." The opposition leader added that the firm steps in the government's program have been used as a political message, now limps and kneels under pressure before the empire. The United States also invaded Panama in 1989 as part of what it called Operation Just Cause to depose leader Manuel Noriega. U.S. troops were accused of killing thousands of civilians, destroying homes, and burying them in mass graves. U.S. human rights advocates have filed a lawsuit to halt President Donald Trump's executive order imposing sanctions on the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, saying that it unconstitutionally infringes upon their freedom of speech. The lawsuit, brought by two advocates represented by the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, argues that the sanctions violate their constitutional rights by restricting their ability to communicate and cooperate with the International Criminal Court. The plaintiffs are Matthew Smith, the co-founder of Fortify Rights, a human rights organization, and Akila Radchakhinskin, an international human rights lawyer. They say that the order bars them from speaking with the ICC's Office of the Prosecutor, Karim Khan, including by providing legal advice and evidence in violation of their rights under the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment. Trump's February 6th order authorized potentially far-reaching economic and travel sanctions on people who work with the ICC investigations of U.S. citizens or U.S. allies, such as Israel. It came after the World Court issued arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Military Affairs Minister Yoav Gallant over their genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza last November. After the warrants, in an overwhelmingly bipartisan response, U.S. politicians from both major parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, with only a few exceptions, expressed outrage and indignation at the court's decision to prosecute Benjamin Netanyahu. Many of them went so far as to question the legitimacy of the ICC itself, condemning the ruling by the International Criminal Court as an affront to Israel and the long-standing relationship between the United States and its ally.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.